Food Not Bombs Radio Network.
And so then you wonder, that's why when you were talking about community control of the police,
right.
This is something that is really vital. It's very important because you see time and time again, these people are blatantly violating, committing the worst kinds of atrocities, human rights abuses all throughout the land and in different parts of the world. Then when you trace it back, you see the training that they receive is kind of universal in a sense. They come together,
right.
You see, and receive that kind of training.
To serve and protect, or to terrorize, murder, and destroy. Coming up on the Food Not Bombs Radio Network. Summer of Resistance, Part 3, The Struggle Against Police Brutality. Today we bring you part 3 of a 4-part series entitled Summer of Resistance, documenting the struggle for justice as it played out on the streets during the summer of 1997. This is the Food Not Bombs Radio Network. I'm Richard Edmondson. The Andy of Mayberry image of the friendly neighborhood policeman probably became passé sometime shortly after the COINTELPRO ravages of the 60s. It was sometime during the early 70s that Andy Taylor stepped aside and Dirty Harry climbed into the driver's seat. Dirty Harry may have broken the rules, but most people trusted that he did it for the right reasons. But on March 3rd, 1991, America's image of its cops underwent another transformation when 12 Los Angeles police officers bludgeoned Rodney King into the pavement and right onto the evening news. Suddenly, Dirty Harry was no longer just dirty. He had become a mindless thug caught up in the grip of a bestial rage. Today, with police brutality at epidemic proportions, our society has come starkly face to face with the haunting specter of someone in a badge and a blue uniform who can seemingly murder at will and get away with it. One of the most basic fears shared by many Americans is fear of the police. But in no sectors of society is this more true than with poor people and people of color. In poor neighborhoods, fear of the police is instinctual and primal. In all too many areas, the police are perceived as an occupying army. In many respects, that's precisely what they are. So widespread has the problem become that police brutality has even become a regular topic on the op-ed page of the New York Times. But all this random battering and shooting of the public has had one strangely wondrous repercussion that perhaps the police and the district attorneys who failed to prosecute them hadn't counted upon. It has brought people together across racial boundaries. After the sodomization of Haitian immigrant Abner Louima by New York City police, thousands of people surged into the streets of Brooklyn and Manhattan in protest. In San Francisco, a multiracial, multiethnic coalition of citizens forced the resignations of several members of the City Police Commission and the firing of a cop who had been implicated in the beating and pepper spray killing of an unarmed African-American man. While across the nation, names are being gathered for something called the Stolen Lives Project, which ultimately hopes to produce a list of victims slain by police nationwide. So acute has become the level of police violence in the United States that some people say it is now approaching third world proportions. One who expresses that opinion is Pierre Labossière of the Haitian American Council of the Bay Area. Labossière was interviewed by Kilu Niasha over Free Radio Berkeley.
Abner was arrested and taken to the station, and on the way to the station, he was beaten. He received at least two beatings, according to the recent reports. And while at the station, he was again beaten viciously, taken to the bathroom where they took a plunger, a toilet plunger. They used a stick and proceeded into putting it through his rectum and bursting his small intestine, messing up his gallbladder, damaging his gallbladder.
Oh, my goodness.
And he was thrown into a cell, where, according to the Haitian Information Documentation Center, many of the prisoners started screaming about providing this man with medical attention. And finally, they called the ambulance and took him to the hospital. And that's where he told what had happened. His family, in the meantime, his brother had gone to the station twice. And his brother was ridiculed by the police. They were making fun of him. They threatened him. They told him if he came back that he would be, they would throw the book at him. And really, the kind of vicious harassment and repression that that too often go unreported, because I'm sure it's not the first time this thing has happened. And if we know that the Amnesty International has had a very, they had listed the New York, the NYPD, on their list of being brutal, and the kind of repression that goes on, the violation, the gross abuses of human rights over the years has been really escalating, and Amnesty International had something in New York about that. And there have been a lot of activities about this situation. But that shows you the callousness. It's as if though the spotlight has been brought on that organization, but still, the police in New York was feeling so much impunity as to think they could continue on
that they could do this, right? Yeah, because it was obvious that they thought that they could get away with this.
Oh yes.
Right.
So the community reacted with outrage. There was a major demonstration in Brooklyn last Saturday,
mm-hmm.
and about 8,000 people, according to one of the organizers, showed up.
Wow, that is a lot of folks.
It was just a spontaneous call that went out by word of mouth, and we had that many folks coming out. They went from the nightclub to the precinct.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other demonstrations planned. But what I'm afraid, my fear in this is that generally we see that when there is such an outrage committed, we see that the police in this case was arrested, at least two policemen, and they are saying that there will be more arrests. But then down the road, you wonder, are these folks going to be punished?
Right.
Is the
As we've seen a lot of them get off.
They get off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's like an appeasement situation, and then after a while, then you go to this trial, then somehow they get acquitted, or they get a little slap on the wrist, a couple of maybe a year or so.
Right.
And then you wonder whatever happens to these folks. And as had happened in the case of Officer Ndaya.
The Officer Ndaya, referred to by Labossiere, is Officer Mark Ndaya. Officer Mark Ndaya was formerly of the San Francisco Police Department. However, in 1995, following the beating and pepper spray killing of an unarmed African-American man, a multiracial coalition of community activists got together and began working for Ndaya's firing. The campaign to have Officer Ndaya removed from the San Francisco Police Department was long and arduous, but was ultimately successful.
Because he went from Oakland to San Francisco.
Right.
Where, thanks to the work of vengeance...
Well, he's not going anywhere anymore.
Well, let's hope
but
so.
But it took 2 years of activity...
Exactly.
...to get him off the force.
Exactly.
And it may take just as much and just as long an effort to get these guys... out of the police force
completely, so that they are
right.
They shouldn't
be on the police force.
Ironically, the same weekend the news was breaking about the assault on Abner Louima, a national conference on police brutality was being held in Chicago. The Food Not Bombs Radio Network's Keith McHenry attended that conference and there spoke with Iris Baez, the mother of Anthony Baez, a young man who was murdered by a New York City police officer in 1994. On December 22nd that year, Anthony Baez and his two brothers were playing football in front of their Bronx home. At one point during the play, the ball got away from the three brothers, bouncing against the patrol car of Officer Francis Lavoti. Lavoti emerged from the car and placed Anthony Baez in a chokehold, killing him. Though receiving a verbal lashing from a judge, Lavoti substantially escaped punishment for the crime. This is Iris Baez.
Yes, because once I started getting in the media, the police wanted to prove that my son died of asthma. And I had to prove that my son did not die of asthma. So I tried to keep it in the media as much as I could until it really got, the case got known. And when the trial started, we did rallies and we did, we're sitting in the DA's office and we demonstrate and we found out that my son did not die of asthma. It was due to the pressure that was put on his neck that he died of suffocation. So we proved. So now we got the police out of job with no pension. I mean, that's not really justice. But we got something that he won't murder nobody while using a uniform.
Right. So, approximately, how many? Do you have a sense of how many people have contacted you who had the same tragedy?
We got hundreds. We got hundreds.
In the U.S. These aren't people from other countries calling.
No, this is just in the Bronx. Brooklyn, in New York City.
Hundreds of people called saying that they have, like, people have died in their family or
their youth. Yes, and now it's that I'm coming out, that I went to Buffalo and I met a group of mothers there that their son been murdered. One was driving a car and the police stopped him and then he said he was of color and he said, why you got a car? He had a porch. So he didn't believe that was his. So he choked him.
Wow.
He choked him because of the car he was driving in. And, you know, little things like that, and this gets me very upset. That's why we have to support the October 22 and the Stolen Life Project. And we have cases that a police went into a house and laid the kids in the floor and then executed them right there, all in the back. And every case that I get involved with has to do with shooting or anything, it's in the back. And then when the first story comes out, it's, we had to shoot him because he took a stand or he was he was in a position where we thought he was gonna, harm was gonna come to me. And then we come out after we get the autopsy, that is all a lie. That they were shot in the back of the head, in the back of the back. And there was one incident in Crown Heights where they said a kid had a machete and he was running towards the cop, and that's why they shot him. But then it turns out that the kid was running away from the cop. There was no way that kid was running towards the cop, and he shot him in the back. You know, and then they, not only the cop that does it, but the police that are there, they cover it up. That's why the Stolen Knife Project is so important, because we're going to go all over the country showing that these people died unnecessarily. And if you don't get it lost, it can be your one of yours next.
Judicial proceedings against Lavoti likely would never have taken place at all had not friends and supporters of the Baez family held sit-ins in the Bronx DA's office. Out in San Francisco, it was similar pressure brought to bear against public officials that finally paid off in the firing of Officer Andaya. The main battlefield in that struggle became the city's weekly police commission meetings.
Commissioners, I am here to ask you to end the agony now and to fire Mark Andaya.
That was Van Jones, director of Bay Area Police Watch, speaking before the police commission with a crowd of supporters packed into the room. Jones is a young firebrand of a civil rights attorney who was instrumental in forging a multiracial coalition in San Francisco, demanding the dismissal of Officer Andaya. Andaya was the ranking officer on the scene when 35-year-old Aaron Williams was brutally beaten and pepper-sprayed to death on June 4, 1995. For 2 years, from 95 to 97, the police commission resisted taking any action against Andaya. However, Jones and his fellow community activists persisted, refusing to let up, dogging, hounding, and haranguing commissioners at their Wednesday night meetings.
We told you that this had happened. It was obvious at that point that it was not in the file. Charges could have been filed against him right then, but they weren't. It came out in the newspaper February 27th that there were glaring omissions from his record. Charges could have been filed on February 27th, and this could be the hearing to fire him. But that did not happen. And what we have now is a situation where we're having stalling tactics and stalling tactics. All about, we have to follow the rules. We have to follow the regulations. When Aaron was dying in a police van, did they care about regulations then?
Yeah!
When police officers stop us on the streets and frisk us down and plant drugs on us, they don't care about rules and regulations then?
Yeah!
What we are dealing with is a situation where there are two classes of people in San Francisco. Everybody else and the cops. It's three strikes for us and 3,000 strikes for these police officers.
Yeah.
And we're tired of it. We're tired of it.
So strident were the activists on Andaya's case that the coalition was accused by one Bay Area newspaper of turning the weekly police commission meetings into an open mic night. Indeed, the presentations, also crossing generational boundaries, had something of a soapbox air, including not only angry speeches by adults, but also teenagers reading their own poetry about the police.
Justice. Is it fair to leave tears and despairs on the hearts of family, community, and eventually society? Is it fair to ignore justice for the victims of abuse, harassment, and police brutality?
And MCing ain't the only tool in my repertoire. I'm about to bring about changes that only the Creator foresaw, or you if you was gifted with the tools that he gave the youth. That is to be able to see, hear, and speak the truth.
Mark Andaya must be fired. It cannot be swept under the rug. He cannot have a desk job like he has now. He cannot postpone this anymore. On June 26th, we expect nothing less from this commission than you fire Mark and I and finally get justice for Aaron Williams.
At times, it seemed as if the strategy of the activists were nothing more than to simply shame the police commission into doing the right thing.
Because as long as you sit on this commission, you are now responsible for what this commission has done. And what this commission has done is unexcusable.
My name is Laboria P. Smore. I'm speaking up for Aaron Williams' family, and I'm speaking for my community as well. We African Americans, we don't have a chance the way the police department are treating us. You can see a direct copy as to what happened here. You can see what happened on the fifth floor, how the treachery that they had devised against us. They didn't even want us to sit in the seats. Now, you know that's wrong. So, what I'm saying here today, we are looking at people with uniforms on who are supposed to protect us. They are not protecting us. We have people who are in the police department who shouldn't be in there. We want them out of there. And you want to keep them there. And we are just constantly talking up for what is right. We speaking up for our human rights. You're taking our human rights away from us. By this gang back there,
after week, activists continued to hammer away, perhaps causing an even further upward ratcheting of the commission's anxiety was the fact that the community commentary was recorded and broadcast, unedited, over a local micro radio station, San Francisco Liberation Radio. Ultimately, three of the five-member commission, including Commission President John Kecker, seemed guided by the old saying, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen.
I will especially miss the command staff and my fellow commissioners who have done, and Ms. Dunlap, all of whom have done a first-class job. The commission is now without a quorum, and it's up to you all. I mean, I've resigned, and we don't have a quorum to listen anymore, so it's up to you all to decide what to do. But I'm out of here.
For those who may not have caught that final bit, Kecker's last words were, I'm out of here. Two other commissioners also tendered resignations. When the new commission was sworn in, one of its first acts was to fire Officer Andaya. But as this summer's incident at the 70th Precinct in New York shows, the problem of police brutality in America is far more serious than that which can be cured by the expulsion of one killer cop and three do-nothing commissioners.
For us in the Haitian community, this is very reminiscent of what the Haitian military and police did to our people.
Right.
And so the whole community has been really, really all the more
outraged. Well, it's been under the auspices of the U.S. government.
Oh, yeah.
Forces, yeah. Because they trained the dictators that were administering this kind of brutality against the Haitian people. So it reverts right back to the U.S. Military, domestic military forces, and international military forces.
Precisely.
And then
you wonder, and you hear about other things happening throughout the country.
Right.
Then you wonder, what kind of training are these folks getting?
Mm-hmm.
Does the United Nations Convention of Human Rights, which the U.S. is a signatory of, does it mean what it says, or does it, you know, what's going on with this? Are our lives worth less than other people's lives? And even when we look at internationally, we take this thing on an international level, we see that there is a school of the Americas where many people, many military and police officers from Latin America come to the U.S. to receive training. And the School of the Americas has graduated so many of the most notorious dictators and bloodthirsty killers in those military and police forces.
Yeah.
Then you are seeing some kind of, so people may say it's a stretch, but it's not really. Because when you see that many of their manuals actually teach or have been reported as teaching or talking about torture.
Oh, they've been exposed. Manuals have surfaced.
That's why when you were talking about community control of the police,
right,
this is something that is really vital. It's very important because you see time and time again, these people are blatantly violating, committing the worst kinds of atrocities, human rights abuses, all throughout the land and in different parts of the world. Then when you trace it back, you see the training that they receive is kind of universal in a sense. They come together,
right,
you see, and receive that kind of training. And you look at what is happening to Alerte Belance. Alerte Belance is a Haitian woman who during the coup
was supporting Aristide. Very courageous woman.
And she came out of hiding thinking Aristide was coming back and to beautify the streets and all of that, and to prepare people and to mobilize the population. Well, they saw her, and she didn't even get a chance to be active. She just returned back to her home, and the FRAP in Haiti, the death squad, took her and mutilated her. And right now, she has had a lawsuit and against the FRAP, the death squad,
right,
and the lawsuit cannot proceed because the U.S. government has all the documents.
Like the only people anywhere that matter are the people out there on the streets, are the people that are out there living their daily lives, who you can help protect. Because 5-0 don't protect us. Because we don't got no property. We ain't got no money. They're here to protect property. That's their main number one job.
On October 22nd, 1997, the Stolen Lives Project will sponsor a nationwide day of protest against police brutality. People attending protests that day are encouraged to wear black. If you know of anyone who has been killed by the police in the last 10 years, you are encouraged to contact the Stolen Lives Project at 1-888-NO-BRUTALITY. That's 1-888-NO-BRUTALITY. This has been Summer of Resistance, Part 3, The Struggle Against Police Brutality. On our next program, we'll bring you the conclusion of our Summer of Resistance series.
Well, I gotta tell you,
he told me to stay here.
It does my heart good to look out here and see all you people, all of you concerned about the Redwoods. It really does.
I hope that I would never have to say this, but we're running out of time. If we don't protect this forest as soon as possible, within the next couple years, we won't have it anymore.
Well, now I got a cop following me over here. Another one over here in the church parking lot. Now Sergeant Clark's following me right now. Yeah, he's coming up on my tail right now.
Judy Berry's death gone. We've only ourselves to rely on. Brother John, it's up to you and me. How shall we respond to the chocolate Albion? Thank you very much.
That's Summer of Resistance, Part 4, Autumn Overview. Coming up next time on the Food Not Bombs Radio Network. All four parts of our Summer of Resistance series are available on cassette for $16 plus $2 postage and handling. Send your check to the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, 750 La Playa, L.A., capital P-L-A-Y-A, box 852, San Francisco, California, 94121. That's the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, 750 La Playa, L-A-P-L-A-Y-A, box 852, San Francisco, California, 94121. If you'd like to get involved in the resistance movement, contact Food Not Bombs at 1-800-884-1136. That's 1-800-884-1136. We'd like to thank Kilu Nyasha of Freedom is a Constant Struggle, Keith McHenry of Food Not Bombs, Free Radio Berkeley, and San Francisco Liberation Radio for their contributions to this program. The music on this program is by Anti-Flag. For the Food Not Bombs Radio Network, I'm Richard Edmondson.